you want to ask the question, what is the role of a PCC in a healthy church, where do you go? And one place it seems to me to go is to look at the place of the king and his counsellors in Israel. It's true that Mark isn't exactly a king, but he is your human leader in the way that a king was for the people of God in the Old Testament. And as we'll see, a king had his counsellors, which is exactly what you are. You're here to give counsel to Mark particularly, and John, and for the church as a whole, as you lead the people of God. So when you turn to 2 Kings chapter 22 and 23. So 2 Kings 22 and 23. And this is the story of Josiah, a good king. Let me just read the very beginning here of chapter 22. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 39 years. Verse 2, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. So it's a story of a good king, and sorry, I meant to change this because it's not verses 2 and 3, but verses 3 and 4, where we find his leaders as well. So in the 18th year, verse 3 of his reign, he'd come of age by this time, King Josiah sent the secretary, Shaphan, son of Azaliah, son of Meshullam, to the temple of the Lord. He said, this is Josiah said, go up to Hilkiah, the high priest. So there are two of the king's cabinet, the secretary and the high priest. And then we hear in verse 12, Josiah gave these orders to Hilkiah the priest, Ahikam son of Shaphan, Achor son of Micaiah, Shaphan the secretary, and Asaiah the king's attendant. In other words, his closest counselors. And this is one way, at least. I mean, it's not exactly, of course, a vicar and his PCC, but it is a leader of the people of God and his immediate counseling leaders. Now, I'd like someone, please, to read the whole of both chapters, but Mark, you probably know who to suggest to read these three sections of 2 Kings.
Phil, would you do 22, 1 to 13?
Sure.
Christina, you have to read 23, 1 to 5?
Yeah.
Brilliant. And Mr. Dinny, why don't you do 21 to 25? Thank you.
Don't worry about the names, just guess at them if you're not...
Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 31 years. His mother's name was Jedidiah, a daughter of Adiah. She was from Boscath. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and walked in all the ways of his father David, not turning aside to the right or to the left. In the 18th year of his reign, King Josiah sent the secretary, Shaphan, son of Azaliah, the son of Meshullam, to the temple of the Lord. He said, go up to Hilkiah, the high priest, and make him get ready the money that has been brought into the temple of the Lord, which the doorkeepers have collected from the people. Make them entrust it to the men appointed to supervise the work on the temple. And make these men pay the workers who repair the temple of the Lord, the carpenters, the builders, and the masons. And make them purchase timber and dress stone to repair the temple. But they need not account for the money entrusted to them, because they are acting faithfully. Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the secretary, I have found the book of the law in the temple of the Lord. He gave it to Shaphan, who read it. Then Shaphan the secretary went to the king and reported to him, your officials have paid out the money that was in the temple of the Lord and have entrusted it to the workers and supervisors at the temple. Then Shaphan the secretary informed the king, Hilkiah the priest has given me a book. And Shaphan read from it in the presence of the king. When the king heard the words of the book of the law, he tore his robes. He gave these orders to Hilkiah the priest, Ahikam, son of Shaphan, Achbor, son of Micaiah, Shaphan the secretary, and Asaiah, the king's attendant. Go and inquire of the Lord for me, and for the people, and for all Judah, about what is written in this book that has been found. Great is the Lord's anger that burns against us, because our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book. They have not acted in accordance with all that is written there concerning us.
Then the king called together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. He went up to the temple of the Lord with the men of Judah, the people of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets, all the people from the least to the greatest. He read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant, which had been found in the temple of the Lord. The king stood by the pillar and renewed the covenant in the presence of the Lord, to follow the Lord and keep his commands, regulations and decrees with all his heart and with all his soul, thus confirming the words of the covenant written in this book. Then all the people pledged themselves to the covenant. The king ordered Hilkiah the high priest, the priests next in rank, and the doorkeepers to remove from the temple of the Lord all the articles made for Baal and Asherah, and all the starry hosts. He burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of the Kidron Valley, and took the ashes to Bethel. He did away with the pagan priests, appointed by the kings of Judah to burn incense in the high places of the towns of Judah and on those around Jerusalem, those who burned incense to Baal, to the sun and moon, to the constellations, and to all the starry hosts.
The king gave this order to all the people: celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God as it is written in the book of the covenant. Not since the days of the judges who led Israel, nor throughout the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, had any such Passover been observed. But in the 18th year of King Uzziah, the Passover was celebrated to the Lord in Jerusalem. Furthermore, Josiah got rid of the mediums and spiritists, the household gods, the idols, and all the other detestable things seen in Judah and Jerusalem. This he did to fulfil the requirements of the law written in the book that Hilkiah the priest had discovered in the temple of the Lord. Neither before nor after Josiah was there a king like him who turned to the Lord as he did, with all his heart, with all his soul, and with all his strength, in accordance with all the law of Moses.
Thank you so much. Well, you probably know that in the book of 1 and 2 Kings, there are bad reigns and good reigns, bad kings and good kings. The reign of Josiah and of his leaders was undoubtedly a good reign. And you remember we saw that, just we've seen it just at the end, but we saw it again in 22 verse 2. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and walked in all the ways of his father David, not turning aside to the right or to the left. Well, we want, and you I'm sure want, in all souls, to learn from good leadership. So what is it that we can learn from Josiah and his leaders about the role of leaders in a New Testament church, and specifically, because that's what you are, the role of a PCC in a healthy church? Well, let's look at the question, what did they discuss? What did they do? And we see here that the king and his leaders were concerned with four things. Four things, I think, that you will find again and again that you as a PCC are discussing. And the first thing is the buildings. The very first thing that we discover, he comes to the throne when he's 8. He's obviously not going to do much at that point. But by the time he's 18, verse 3, the very first thing he does, verse 3, sends Shaphan the secretary and says to him, verse 4, go up to Hilkiah the high priest and make him get ready the money that has been brought into the temple of the Lord, which the doorkeepers have collected from the people. Make them entrust it to the men appointed to supervise the work on the temple. And make these men pay the workers who repair the temple of the Lord, the carpenters, the builders, and the masons. Also make them purchase timber and dress stone to repair the temple. So the temple had been built by Solomon some few hundreds of years beforehand, and it had gradually fallen into disrepair. And so one of the first things that the leader had to do, in this case King Josiah, together with his cabinet, was to look after the temple building. And that wasn't a straightforward exercise, it was quite complex. It involved collecting money. Verse 4, go up to Hilkiah the priest and make him get ready the money that has been brought into the temple of the Lord, which the doorkeepers have collected from the people. We don't know what that was exactly, the collection. It might have been a sort of embryonic temple tax. You remember by certainly New Testament times they were paying a temple tax. It might have been free will offerings that were being made in pursuit of a vow or something like that. But in any case, money was being collected by the doorkeepers for the repair of the buildings. It meant supervising the work. Did you notice that in verse 5? Make them entrust this money to the men appointed to supervise the work on the temple. So they were, as it were, project managers or a project management team that looked after the work of repairing these precious buildings. And they were accounting for the money. Actually, the first thing we're told, amazingly, verse 7, is that they don't need to account for the money entrusted. Sorry, I've missed this point. I should have got, and I didn't click it at the right moment either. I should have got that they employed tradesmen. Did you notice that? Make these men, at the end of verse 5, pay the workers who repair the temple of the Lord, the carpenters, the builders, and the masons. Also make them purchase timber and dressed stone to repair the temple. So they sought out skilled workmen who knew their trade and gave them the money. And then I was just talking about accounting for the money, and as I said, the first thing we're told is they didn't need to account for it. Amazingly, verse 7, they need not account, this is the tradesmen, for the money entrusted to them, because they are acting faithfully. Isn't that a lovely testimony to honest tradesmen? But actually, if you look at verse 9, there was accounting. Then Shaphan the secretary went to the king and reported to him, your officials have paid out the money that was in the temple of the Lord, and have entrusted it to the workers and supervisors at the temple. So they reported back to the king and said that the money had indeed been allocated as he had given instructions. Well, it's not difficult, is it, to see the relevance of all that to a PCC in a healthy church. You're certainly concerned with buildings, and just as with Josiah, I was a little bit older than 18 when I was made Vicar of All Saints in Crowbury, but I hadn't even got as far as having been appointed, or at least having been instituted, before a building project was thrust on me by the church wardens. I think I'm looking in the direction of the church wardens, aren't I? Is that right? So I arrived in the church, and the church warden said to me, this is, I say, before I arrived, that we've overgrown the church and we need to build out. They were suggesting knocking down two walls and sort of completing a square. And I said to them, that's going to cost an immense amount of money for 50 extra seats. If we're going to do that, don't you think we've got to think much, much more radically than that? And so over a period of time, we looked actually as a PCC at three different options. We already had four services on a Sunday. We looked at the option of a fifth service on a Sunday. We looked at the option of planting a church. And we looked at the option of enlarging the church. And in the end, it wasn't an easy decision at all. We had a whole PCC morning devoted to two of those options with professional advice on both occasions. Actually, it was a very, very exciting PCC, because at the end of the PCC, when the options were presented to us inevitably. You know how this happens. The presenters went over time. I'll probably do that this morning, or this afternoon. And I turned to my church warden and I said, "We've only got half an hour to discuss this. Do you think we should lengthen the morning?" And the church warden said to me, "No, Andrew, you said we'd be through by lunch. We must finish then." And I thought, well, there were two brilliant presentations. They're both extremely exciting. We'll probably be split completely down the middle if we don't have time to discuss it. And we hardly discussed it at all. And then I went round and I said, "No, I'd just like each of you to say which one of these you think is the right one to do." And every single person in the room said, "We need to enlarge the church." And it was one of those amazing moments that you very, you know, I look back at it still and my heart just misses a beat. Not expected for one moment, but to have unanimity on the PCC was a terrific thing. I know you're thinking of building, and one of the principles that we went through was to say this is the church family's home. We are a church family. One of you prayed in that way about yourself. And this is our home as a church family. And that means that it needs to be what we would expect in a home. It needs to be comfortable. For us, that meant pulling out all the rather hard pews and putting in seats. It needs to be warm. We put in a whole new heating system so that people don't have to come to church and keep their coats on. You don't go into a person's house and expect to keep your coat on. There need to be enough loos. So in the previous church I was in London, there was one loo for the whole church and an immense queue to get into it. And it wasn't even in the church building itself, it was in another building. And so we had to think there, when we were involved in a big building project there, we've just got to provide many, many more loos. And in our current church, everywhere you look, there are loos. And more recently, we've been, again, trying to think of how we can make this still more a home for the church family. It's not only, of course, in a big building project. One issue that every PCC faces is quinquennials. Every 5 years, as you well know, you get the architect in. This is mandatory, and report on the state of the fabric and the buildings. It's been our policy as a PCC not only to maintain, but every time we have a quinquennial, to improve as well, to do something that's an improvement. So the last quinquennial we did, we just thought our entrance way. Well, you came in. We do have a porch. You came in through an outside door, which would be open, and then you come in to a porch where there was just another wooden door. So you've no idea what you're going into. So we took out those doors, put in glass doors, so that you can see through, and made it much more welcoming in terms of the lighting and the displays and so on. So always not just wanting to get it back up to maintain a given standard, but constantly be thinking, as you would do in your own home, how can we just make it slightly better and more welcoming? And exactly the same, it's very important, I think, where you do have staff members, vicar, curate, whoever, that you look after the staff housing. Now, you as a PCC don't see that, but church wardens and PCC must be thinking all the time, are there improvements we should be making to the housing our staff is in? I remember when I was a curate, my vicar didn't normally come to my house. Came to my house, and he looked at the... obviously, it's not my house, it was a church house. And I had a yellow carpet that I'd inherited, which was stained all over. And he looked at it, and he said, "Andrew, this is appalling. We must get you a new carpet." And then he went away and forgot about it. And I didn't have the heart to say to him, "Michael, do you remember you said I needed a new carpet?" So I don't know if the carpet's changed now. It's still a church house now. Depends whether the vicar went back again, I guess. But that's a thing that, and if I may say so, you ladies particularly, you're much better at having an eye for these things. If the kitchen is hopelessly out of date, or you know, you are told, well, the loo's upstairs in the bathroom, and you just think it's so antiquated, this bathroom, you need to be bringing that to the attention of the PCC. So buildings. Secondly, the teaching of the Bible. That's a second thing that Josiah and his cabinet were concerned with. Look at chapter 22, verse 8. Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the secretary, "Look, as we've been rummaging around in the temple, I have found the book of the law in the temple of the Lord." He gave it to Shaphan, who read it. Then Shaphan went to the king. He reported on the building. And then, verse 10, Shaphan the secretary informed the king, "Hilkiah the priest has given me a book." And Shaphan read from it in the presence of the king. And when the king heard the words of the book of the law, he tore his robes, and so on. Now, it may well be a secretary was a very important person in the ancient Near East because he could read and write. And it may be that in this case he read it to the king because the king wouldn't have been able to read it himself. But certainly the situation was that they read it together, and then in fact, in the next verse, verse 12, Josiah gives orders to involve not only Hilkiah, but Ahikam and Akbor and Shaphan and Asaiah all together to make them aware of what is in the book of the law, and then, as we'll see later on, to act on it. So the leaders together reading and reading the Bible together, and secondly taking it with great seriousness. So it doesn't say when the king heard the words of the book of the law, it just went over his head. He tore his robes, verse 11, and he gave these orders to his cabinet, verse 12, "Go and inquire of the Lord for me and for the people and for all Judah about what is written in this book that has been found. Great is the Lord's anger that burns against us because our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book. They've not acted in accordance with all that is written there concerning us." So do you see, when the leaders together, the king and his leaders, read the words of the book of God's law, then they took it with immense seriousness and immediately said, "We've got to find out more about this, and then we've got to act on it. We've got to make changes based on the Bible." Actually, almost all the rest of these two chapters is about that, so just see a small amount of it here. In verses 4, chapter 23, verses 4 and 5. "Then the king ordered Hilkiah the priest, the priests next in rank," I guess that's the curate, "and the doorkeepers, to remove from the temple of the Lord all the articles made for Baal and Asherah and all the starry hosts. He burnt them outside Jerusalem in the fields of the Kidron Valley and took the ashes to Bethel. He did away with the pagan priests appointed by the kings of Judah to burn incense on the high places of the towns of Judah and on those around Jerusalem, those who burnt incense to Baal, to the sun and moon, to the constellations, and to all the starry hosts." It's rather exciting, actually. One of the things I do sometimes is to lead trips to Israel. And when you go to Beersheba, there's a house there, and when they excavated down beneath the house, they found some of the idols that had been purged, almost certainly in this purge of King Josiah. They'd gathered them together from the local sanctuary and they'd buried them right below. They destroyed them and then buried them underneath the foundations of the house. So there's a place for doing things right. We'll see that in accordance with the Bible as the leaders gather together. And there's a place for putting right what has been wrong, stopping things, even asking people to step down from leadership who are inappropriate, who are not able to lead in accordance with the Bible's teaching. Well, this means that it's very important that the Bible is at the centre of the life of the PCC. Yeah. You may do the same yourselves. We normally begin our PCC meetings with a brief description, as we just had, deep, brief explanation of a passage of the Bible, and then prayer together. I'm not sort of absolutely immediately leaving, but I'm 65, so it's going to be sometime soon, and it just so happens that November, as I understand it, is the last month in which a PCC can take the decision, if they want to do that, that there should not be a woman incumbent. Now, I don't know which way our PCC will vote on this, but my church warden said, we think this is a question we should discuss. Actually, until November, it's a question which, when a incumbent leaves, you may remember this, those of you on the PCC, you have to decide whether you're going to discuss it. And church warden said, I think it is a question we should face. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give them the question, and then I'm going to give the PCC about 25 or 30 different references from Scripture which have been used on one side and on the other of the argument for them to go away and wrestle with, and then at our next PCC meeting we will have a discussion based firmly on the Bible as to what the Bible says about the leadership of men and women and its applicability to church life today. So I mentioned that just because it's the next thing coming up, but there may be issues when you need really to get your noses in the Bible together as you discuss some major concern of yours as a church family. We face this again in decisions about our mission partners. So there was a time when anybody who went out from All Saints Crowborough to do anything abroad was immediately accepted as a mission partner. But recently we've been reviewing this and we've said, no, we feel in order to be a mission partner, then either evangelism, bringing the Christian message for the first time to people, or building up the church by Bible teaching must be a significant part of their work if they're going to be accepted as a mission partner. If somebody goes out, like Eleanor, who's here staying with you as an occupational therapist, to work and do what's called, isn't it sometimes, an elective, a medical person just happens to be working abroad in a secular capacity, then we would say, we're right behind that, that's great, but not as a mission partner. If you're going to be a mission partner, then there needs to be some kind of Bible teaching or evangelism. That's a decision we've taken. You may take a different decision. But it's to show that the Bible is at the centre of our thinking as a PCC. Maybe there are issues within the Church of England. So when the Pilling report about possible changes in order to become more accepting of same-sex relationships and possibly even a recommendation that there might be some kind of service of blessing when a same-sex relationship begins, we felt that that was a question we had to look at as a PCC and discuss, and then to seek to put forward what we understood to be a biblical understanding to our General Synod members and to our bishops within this diocese. Another issue which some years ago we spent a lot of time wrestling with was the issue of church discipline. So what happens if a member of your church family starts living with someone to whom he or she is not married? What do you do then? Do you just turn a blind eye, sweep it under the carpet? Or is there something that, some action that you need to take? Or if, for example, to give an example of someone I met just this week from our church family, somebody who's married leaves their husband or wife for someone else, and then subsequently gets married to that person, can we just completely accept this new marriage when in the case I'm thinking of, two families have been broken up? That's not an easy question, is it? We got a group, actually got our then curate, who was Mike Ovey at the time, and a group of people, including in fact my wife, to work on this together, to look at it biblically and to come back with recommendations for what we should do as a PCC in those circumstances. So the second thing they gave themselves to was the teaching of the Bible. Here's the third thing: the commitment of the people. So if you look at this is the commitment to God of the whole people. If you look at chapter 23 now, then the king called together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. He went up to the temple of the Lord with the men of Judah, the people of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets, all the people from the least to the greatest. He read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant which had been found in the temple of the Lord. The king stood by the pillar and renewed the covenant in the presence of the Lord to follow the Lord and to keep his commands, regulations and decrees with all his heart and all his soul, thus confirming the words of the covenant written in this book. Then all the people pledged themselves to the covenant. It's very important that as a PCC you are concerned with the spiritual growth of the whole church family. We have a daughter church called St. Richard's, and they have their own, they're called the management team, but it's really like a mini PCC. And the full PCC gets the minutes of all their meetings. And I said to our pastoral leader there, Graham, it's great what you're doing on the management team, but I noticed that it's all about finance and buildings. And I think if you're going to do the job fully, we need to see questions like evangelism and the growth of the church family and deepening the spiritual life of the whole church family and so on. Those things need to be appearing on the sort of PCC agenda on a regular basis. In fact, really, buildings and finance, so they've got to be there all the time. And for sometimes they become the major thing, but really they should be minor, because they're only a means to an end of the growth of the commitment of the people of God. Now, did you notice here that this involves everyone? The concern is not just for the leaders, the people of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets. It's verse 2, all the people, from the least to the greatest. And at the end of verse 3, all the people pledged themselves to the covenant. So every single person, not just those in-home groups, but those not in-home groups. Not just those who are active, but those who are housebound. And it was, you won't be surprised in this context, it was based on the Bible. So the growth that they were looking for was to be a growth that was based on verse 2, the reading in their hearing of all the words of the book of the covenant. And then it was a commitment to what at the end of verse 3 is called the words of the covenant written in this book. And so, as a PCC, you should be concerned. What are we teaching in the Sunday school? Are we teaching the Bible there? Are the children really getting to know the Bible? Is the syllabus right? Or is it rather using the Bible as a jumping-off point? In the home groups, are we really getting into the Bible? And if we're not, are there ways in which, as a PCC, we can recommend that the Bible may become more central to home group life? And it involved wholehearted obedience. Did you notice that? The king, it's got to start with the boss man, it's got to start with the vicar. He's got to follow the Lord, verse 3, and keep his commandments, regulations and decrees with all his heart and all his soul. But there's no lesser standard for the whole people of God, end of verse 3, than all the people pledged themselves to the covenant. So in any church, there is, isn't there, there's circles of commitment. I'm not meaning here what's easier to see, circles of involvement. There's certainly that, isn't there? So if you go from the outside, there are those who come, at Christmas and Easter. And then there are those who are there once or twice a month. And then there are those who are there every Sunday without fail. And if they're not there, you're worried. And then there are those who are not just doing that, but they're involved in home groups. And then there are those who are doing that and involved in home groups and serving the Lord very actively and so on. That's true, but that's all outward, isn't it? And this is about commitment to Jesus Christ. More difficult to evaluate, but actually it's not necessarily the case, even that the people who are right at the heart of the church family are really wholehearted with all their heart and soul and might and strength. And it may actually be that some who perhaps for domestic or health reasons are a bit further out in terms of their attendance at things, who are actually more wholehearted in their obedience to Christ. But it's the commitment of people in the church family that you as a PCC need to have at the very heart of your concerns. Finance is great, but it's only finance to build up the people of God and to extend his kingdom to more and more people in Eastbourne. I don't know if you know the Methodist Covenant Service. It's actually a very lovely service which the Methodists hold every year, and it's basically a service of renewing wholehearted commitment to Christ. I suppose the nearest thing the Anglicans have is our reaffirmation of baptismal vows. I don't know if that's a service you ever have. And we sometimes have that on Easter Sunday evening if we don't have adult baptisms. Then we often have adult baptisms on Easter Sunday evening. But if not, we have a service of reaffirmation of baptismal vows. Another thing that we have normally had every year is what we call a commissioning for ministry service. So we have over 100 different ministries in the church. And every September, we didn't do it this year for various reasons, but we've done it for years and years and years. The groups stand up, we ask them some questions about their commitment to their service, they respond, we recommission them publicly and pray for them. And at the end, the whole church family stands up in order to recommit our lives to Christ and to his service. Commitment, but also, of course, we need to help in that by running various training courses. It's been my practice with our curates normally to give them a specific title and task. So I've had a number of curates in my 25 years, and two of them have been called Director of Training and have run. One of them ran, but two of them, come to think of it, ran. So both of them are called directly Director of Training, ran year-long courses in Christian discipleship, which they had made up. And then actually I did have one whom I called Director of Leadership Training, and he ran a year-long leadership training course, which have, all of those courses as we've run them have been quite revolutionary for the lives of some of the people who have done them. I've done it with curates, and I actually also used a retired clergyman once to do a training course of that sort. Those are year-long courses. Lent, of course, is another great time to be thinking specifically, what do we need as a church family? So we've done a Lent course entirely devoted to how to read the Bible on your own at home. Another Lent course entirely devoted to growing in prayer. We've done, as perhaps you have done, and a lot of churches have done, using the 40 Days of Purpose Rick Warren book, which again was terrific actually. We got a large, large number of people in the church. 96 more people joined a home group at the end of that course as a way of further committing their life to Christ. Another thing we do is what we call strengthen your faith. This is where some of us who are we invite everybody in the church family to meet with one of the leaders of the church, one-to-one or one-to-two if it's a couple. Give them a questionnaire beforehand about how they're doing as a Christian. And then we'll meet with them for about an hour and a half, to talk through how their Christian life is developing and, in particular, what's the next step that Jesus wants you to take. And that's something, of course, that we discussed beforehand on the PCC. And all this needs staff. As a church grows, while I know Mark is concerned that he doesn't want to take leadership away from laymen and women, a church cannot continue to expand its ministry, or even simply to care with its present ministry with expanding numbers of people, unless staff are added. So after our building project, I got the church family together and I said, look, we've got a much bigger facility, there's so much more we can do, what about increasing our staff? And the whole church family together voted that we should add, if possible, 4 extra members of staff, which over a period of time, quite a short period of time actually, we did. So the commitment of the people, and lastly, you'll be pleased to hear, Mark, the worship of the people. The worship of the people. That's something, again, that the king and his cabinet were involved with. Look across to chapter 23, verses 21 to 23. The king gave this order to all the people, celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God, as it is written in this book of the covenant. Not since the days of the judges who led Israel, nor throughout the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, had any such Passover been observed. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was celebrated to the Lord in Jerusalem. So here was a service of the worship of Passover. This was a service, of course, which remembered God and his salvation, the time when he led the people out of Egypt, out of slavery, into freedom eventually in the promised land. Our equivalent of that, of course, is what we call Holy Communion. What we call the Last Supper was a Passover meal, which Christ reinterpreted and reconfigured, as it were. And it's become, obviously, the central service of the Christian church. So as a PCC, you are actually mandated, legally, to discuss and decide on the worship of the church. And one of the questions that you'll have is the place of Holy Communion. And even when it's not specifically communion, is God and his salvation, is the cross of Jesus Christ central to all our worship? Notice that it was a worship based, again, I'm sounding like a cracked record, but then so does 2 Kings 22 and 23, that's based on the Bible. Celebrate, verse 21, the Passover to the Lord your God, as it is written in the book of the covenant. So it's the Bible that shapes worship. And thirdly, it was renewed. Not, says verse 22, since the days of the judges who led Israel, nor throughout the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, had any such Passover been observed. It's not that no Passover was observed. We hear of that in earlier reigns, Hezekiah's, for example. But it hadn't been done according to the book of the covenant. And so here they renew the worship, rethink it. It's not a question of, oh, we've always done it this way, it's going to be like this forever. But it's saying, is it the best that it could be as far as biblical worship is concerned? And Josiah said, no, it isn't. We must change it. Well, one of our great heritages, of course, is that with the Book of Common Prayer Anglican worship is fundamentally biblical. You think of the service of morning and evening prayer. Absolutely shot through with scripture read or sung. And many of the prayers in the Book of Common Prayer can be traced directly to biblical passages. That is not always quite as evident in Common Worship, the sort of new prayer book of the Anglican Church, and therefore within the multiplicity of options. Mark, of course, and John primarily, but you, the PCC, need to be choosing within that those options which most faithfully reflect the teaching of the Bible. And then constantly reviewing and being willing to change the church's worship. So our evening service had not been flourishing. It had been beginning to, after having flourished, it had been beginning to decline. We said we've got to do something about it. So we set aside 2 days, about five of us came together, five or six of us. And the first thing we said was, I said, I want you to come with two or three passages of the Bible, maybe short, maybe longer, that you think are absolutely relevant to shaping our worship. So each one brought them, and we spent all of the first day and some of the second day just going through those passages of the Bible and saying, now, what does this tell us about worship? What does this tell us about worship? What does this tell us about worship? And then in the second two-thirds of the second day, we said, okay, so what does that mean for our evening worship? How are we going to bring these different principles together and reshape, renew our worship to ensure that what we've seen in the Bible is faithfully lived out? Well, those are some of the things that that Josiah and his cabinet were concerned with. And what's the verdict of the Bible on the king and his leadership team? Look at chapter 23, verses 24 and 25. It says, furthermore, Josiah got rid of the mediums and spiritists and so on. This he did to fulfill the requirements of the law, written in the book that Hilkiah the prophet had discovered in the temple of the Lord. Neither before nor after Josiah was there a king like him who turned to the Lord as he did, with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his strength, in accordance with all the law of Moses. Wouldn't it be wonderful if, when the history of All Souls Eastbourne is written up in 100 years' time, the historians said, you know, the period, I don't know, 2010 to 2020 was a golden age in the life of All Souls, because there was a vicar and a PCC who were utterly united in making sure that the Bible moulded everything that the church did, and the church moved forward under God in numbers and in depth.